Today on Maine Calling, Shift, one woman's story about profound change. Penny Geisinger didn't know what was coming. She was in her mid-30s, living in down East Maine, married to a man named John, and the mother of two young children when she met the love of her life, a woman named Kara. Geisinger's memoir, Shift, explores how she got to this point and what happened next. It's an exploration not only of coming out later in life, but also of expectations, feminism, alcohol, and the whiplash when everything is upended. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk with Penny Geisinger about her life and her decision to write a frank and intimate memoir about it. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Calling. Our guest today has quite a story to tell, and she has shared that in a new award-winning memoir, Shift, a memoir of identity and other illusions. Joining me for the hour, Penny Geisinger, who is the author of Shift. It recently won the Maine Literary Award for Memoir. Her earlier book, you may have read, called Postcards from Here. Penny is also an editor, musician, and photographer. We invite you to join the conversation. Have you experienced a major shift in your life or in your identity? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Penny Geisinger, welcome to Maine Calling, and congratulations on your very recent award.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a thrill to be here.
Well, it's so interesting because on one level, your memoir is a story about coming out later in life. But the phrase coming out kind of implies that there had been something hidden, that all along you knew that you were gay. And that's not exactly the case, is it? You didn't think of yourself as a closeted lesbian in your 20s and early 30s.
Yeah, that's completely correct. Good close reading. When we think about coming out, we do, I think the traditional story is someone has been hiding an identity and then makes a decision not to do that anymore for whatever, you know, the circumstances are that change. But that was not the case. I did not spend my early life feeling like I was covering anything up. I fell in love, and it happened to be with someone of the same sex and gender as me, and I did not see it coming.
Yeah. As a teenager, you're right, you had friends who were guys. How did you feel about your friends?
As a teenager,
as a kid, you know, you had friends who were boys, not attracted to them, but I think you wrote that you wanted to be them.
At times, yes. That's accurate. I also had crushes on boys as a teenager, and then boyfriends as a young adult. It all felt very traditional and heteronormative. And I didn't, you know, as I look back now, there are things that feel clearer. That, you know, there was a girl that I had an intimate relationship with, but we sort of cast it as something else, right? So we can tell ourselves stories as they're happening and label things in ways that feel comfortable at the time, but it didn't click that I might not be just straight and cis until it did.
Well, you know, that's interesting that you say that it didn't click, because one of the many things that struck me about your memoir, and I do want to get to you meeting Kara and your life, but you were not, you say in the book that your parents were back to the lander, so you were not raised in a father knows best, leave it to beaver kind of family anyway. A little bit of a countercultural family, but still, even given that, there were many parts you know, of what you assumed about yourself and how you'd live that were very conventional. And so I'm reading this and I'm thinking, isn't it interesting that even though Penny's family was different, there were still all these assumptions that you would fall into certain patterns that are, you know, in the dominant culture.
Yes, absolutely. It was a shock to everybody, even though, as you say, we were kind of in a counterculture in our family. Because by the time it happened, I was an adult and married and had two kids. And so it wasn't just my story anymore or the story of the person I was involved with. There was a whole family unit that was being impacted. And so that gets into, you know, grandparent expectations and cousin expectations and, you know, sort of the life that everybody imagines we're all about to have together is now looking different.
Well, you mentioned that you met and married a man, and he seems from your book like a very good person. And you did this unquestioningly. You have two small children, and then you met Kara. I don't want to give away any more because you write so beautifully about it in the book. Tell us about realizing you were in love with her, and I will rephrase the question by saying, tell us about realizing you were in love with her.
Right. That's good. So it happened kind of slowly. You know, we met at a party, at a potluck. We both showed up at the potluck carrying guitars and knowing Indigo Girls songs, which is probably like the gayest thing that's ever happened. And and then we started a friendship. I was seeking some outlet for playing music and somebody to play music with, and Kara is a very accomplished musician, and so we started getting together to play music, and it was through those times of spending time together and making meals and playing music and hanging out and watching American Idol and doing silly things that friends do together that we both, you know, at the same time started to realize that this was more than just a friendship. But we could not talk about it. We could not acknowledge it. We couldn't say it out loud, which is different from dating, right? Like if you're dating and interested in meeting somebody, you go into an interaction like that more aware of where it could lead. But we did not have that awareness. So as it was happening, it was so forbidden, because I was straight and married, and so we couldn't even talk about it. By the time we had a conversation about it, which we just refer to as the conversation, we were in it kind of up to our eyeballs. And that was a different experience, to be so far in love with somebody before you've even identified that that's a possibility was...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we should say a really important part of the story is this is not recent past. You're talking about 15, 16, 17 years ago.
Yes, I'm super bad at timelines, but it was that long ago.
Because it strikes me that one of the things is that this is a story about a woman. Your memoir is a story about a woman of a certain generation that in part... somebody 25 years younger would probably not have the same story you have.
I think that's absolutely true. Yeah. It's a different time. It doesn't seem that long ago, but it's been an action-packed culture shift time. You know, people are more open and I don't really like the word accepting, but I want to say it's safer now. I also want to not say that it's safer now because things are changing again right under our feet. That's complicated. But yeah, I imagine, you know, all this time later, it would be different for somebody. I don't know that it would be easier or better, but it would be different.
Or a young woman who's a teenager or in her 20s may consider the idea that she may not be straight in a way that maybe not somebody in our generation would have.
It's possible. Yeah.
You know, I want to ask you, Penny, about your decision to write a memoir. You know, as anybody who's listening can tell, you wrote about very, very personal things, as personal, as intimate as you can possibly be. And did you ever sit there at your keyboard or typewriter or writing longhand? I don't know how you write and think, why am I doing this?
So I'm a writer and have been a writer for a long time, and so as it was happening, I'm also aware, like, this is a great story, this is compelling, and I should be writing it down. I don't think I tackled it as a book until we were pretty far into our relationship, living together, etc. But I am not a private person. I am not precious about this information or this story. I don't think anything has happened to me at its that at it, at its core that has not happened to a lot of other people, even if the specifics are different. Falling in love in an unexpected way to someone that you didn't expect to fall in love with, finding a different life, making really huge decisions that have a big impact, like. Those things have happened to a lot of people. So that's the story I'm really telling. And you should know I am married to a person who is a very private person. And so Kara is a very private person. And so it was different for her. And we did have to do some negotiation, although it really wasn't a negotiation. I just gave her veto power. Here's the manuscript. If there's anything in it that you really don't want to have out in the world, you can say so. And there were some things that you will not read because she said no to those things, but it's okay.
You titled your book Shift.
Mm-hmm.
As you look back, do you think that something changed in you?
Yes, and also no. And this is one of the core metaphors of the book is this concept of how did I completely transform my sense of self and my identity and how people see me, and yet I'm exactly the same person that I've always been, right? I have the same values and I care about the same things, and but there was a feeling of having come out, or whatever phrase we want to use, because we, well, that's another topic. Anyway, having come out and having told the people closest to me, this is what's happening, and now we're together, and we're living this life now. There was a sense of really fully being in my own skin in a way that I had not felt before. And maybe that's because of a change in sexual identity, or maybe that's because I finally just landed in the life that was the right life for me with this person, right? I don't really know. It doesn't really matter that much, but I
So many
did have.
themes are threaded throughout the book, and one of them, Penny, is how after, I'll use the word coming out, the phrase coming out for lack of a better term,
Well, we have.
after coming out, you realize many things straight people take for granted because you've lived now both ways.
Right, just walking down the street holding hands. We still have to think about that. Little tiny things. We're in a restaurant, we always get asked one check or two. There's just a myriad of ways that we go through the world differently than, or that I do than when I was a straight person. And yeah.
Yeah. It makes me sad to hear that you still think about that in public. Do you think it's because of where you live in Maine?
Well, I mean, if I were in Provincetown, Massachusetts, I certainly would not think about it twice. But I would think about it in Portland. I mean, we always just have to be, I don't want to say we, because not everybody maybe feels that way, but we're always aware of who's around us and where we are. And increasingly so now, it feels like there's a heightened sense of nervousness recently.
You talk about a little bit feminism and being raised a feminist and thinking of yourself as a feminist. And yet, in some ways, feminism not being enough, or maybe I'm trying to think of the right way to put it, selling you a false bill of goods?
Oh, that's an indictment. So what I remember being in the book about that is that I did, when I was married to a man, there were very traditional gender roles that we fell into. And I was trying to do it all. I was the primary breadwinner, and I was raising two little kids, and I was the, you know, I was Julie, the cruise director of our house, which is a Love Boat reference, which a lot of people might not get. and I, you know, I don't know that I felt betrayed by feminism, but I did, you know, there's that reckoning of like, oh, we're not done. You know, there's a lot more to be done. And, yeah.
Yeah. So in this whole idea of everything that you were doing in your marriage, that you were feeling like you were doing it all, and I don't think you use the word trapped, but it sounds like feeling a little trapped, wasn't just about your sexuality.
Correct. Right. Right. And I think that's a big part of this story is that I can tell this story as I was straight and married to a man, and then I met a woman and became not so straight, or realized I was not completely straight, or whatever language we want to use, or I was bisexual, or and so then I left that marriage and now I'm with a woman. But it's also just a love story of like I was in a relationship that wasn't working, and then I met somebody else and left that relationship to be with in a relationship that was working. And the that telling the genders of the people become not so relevant.
You view all this in sort of like these broader concepts come in as well, time and space and the nature of truth and Mobius strips. And so, Penny, I know you have a small passage you'll read to us that will kind of set up what I mean by that. Go ahead.
Yes, it did all start with a Mobius strip that I got into these weird metaphors. So our limited verb tenses can't express what the physicists say, that time and space are more alike than different. My present is here and my past is next to me, just as I am in the living room and my dog is in the kitchen. Time is a three-dimensional box. Run and ran, type and typed, eat and ate, love and loved, losing and lost, all float in proximity to each other in this block theory of time. If it weren't so dark in the box, they could see each other, and we would encounter our past selves so often it wouldn't even seem weird, which is why I feel like I never left my old life when I entered this new one, and like my new life was a place I already knew when I got here. Years after all this happened, during a late night trip to Portland, Maine with my 15-year-old daughter, I would steer my car into a hotel parking lot and notice a pair of glowing yellow loops floating overhead in the fog. It was the logo of Infinity Credit Union next to the hotel, and because my head was already full of thoughts about time as an infinitely large box that goes on forever, the logo made me glance at my daughter and see her as a shimmering hologram, something that never would have happened if I had lived only one linear life.
Hmm. That voice is Penny Geisinger. She's the author of the new memoir, Shift. Shift, a memoir of identity and other illusions. We're going to take a quick break. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are discussing the new book, Shift, a memoir of identity and other illusions. Here to talk about her life story and what she explores is the author of that, Penny Geisinger. We invite you to join the conversation. Send a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now is Christopher McLaughlin. He is a behavioral health provider, educator, and social worker, and owner of the Inspired Consulting Group. Thanks so much for calling in, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Jennifer.
I know you work with a lot of young people in your practice, and I'm wondering, when you listen to our conversation with Penny and you're hearing about this concept of a shift in identity or coming to terms with your identity, is this something that resonates with you and the young people you work with?
Oh, it sure does. I've worked with a lot of young people and thinking of the families I've worked with and older folks as well, who just go through these giant shifts of how they see themselves. And sometimes it might be connected to a change in grade level or a change in peer groups for the younger kiddos, processing maybe trauma. And for these kiddos, these shifts come during times in their life when they're trying to figure out, who am I now?
Mm. And it's interesting because you said young people and older people, this idea of who am I now seems as though it's a moving target, that sometimes we really never know who we are.
That can be the case for lots of us. And I even can reflect on my own personal experience of times of my life where I found myself kind of wondering, who am I now? And what does that mean in context of who have I been? And sometimes that shift in thinking can be empowering. It can feel like stepping into a new place, a place that maybe I or others were meant to be. And other times in my life, that thought process can be or has been really disorienting.
You know, I'm going to put you on pause, Chris, and turn back to Penny, though, because Penny, I think that what Chris just said is reflected in what you write in your memoir, the empowering but also disorienting.
Those words feel really accurate to me. Yeah, exactly. There is something really empowering about claiming I am this person now, or I always have been this person, but I'm claiming it today. And yet it is confusing.
Chris, let me ask you some advice for someone who might be listening today and struggling with who they are or how they're perceived by others. What are some tools?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jennifer, and I really commend Penny for sharing her story in this such a public way. It's such an important story to be told. You know, for me, it comes down to listening, and listening with curiosity, not assumptions. That part of that disorientation, I think, can come when we are met with resistance, when we are met with maybe folks who had some preconceived notions, stereotypes, especially when it comes to issues of gender or sexuality. And there's so much stigma and so much misinformation out there, especially in the world we find ourselves living in today. So one of my fail-safes as a behavioral health provider, as a social worker, and as a friend, as a husband, as a son, as a brother, to show up with curiosity, show up with care, listen with real intentionality. And by that, I mean the purpose of my listening is to best understand and believe the person that I'm supporting, whether I'm in a professional setting or in a personal setting. I think all of us just want to find those spaces where we can be. And it's okay to try on or to share these new shifts, these new identities. And for me, it's all about our desire to belong and to have community and to be surrounded by folks who have my best interest in mind, who want me to feel safe, who want me to feel affirmed. And so listening, number one, not judging, not coming at this, trying to convince somebody that this is a phase or this is something they will outgrow, or they're copying what they're seeing other peers doing. These are the narratives I hear all the time, Jennifer, in working with LGBTQ plus youth. And so believe them, support them, listen to them, be curious with them, and check my assumptions and check my own needs and values and ego at the door.
Wonderful advice for friends and family of loved ones who are feeling a shift. How about for the person themselves who's feeling disoriented by what's going on?
Yeah, I think what I've come to learn, again, professionally and personally, is that people thrive when they are met with validation and they're met with care and genuine concern. People thrive. And especially for queer youth, this is beyond just simply surviving. We want these young folks to also thrive and be free to continue to explore these shifts. And for some of us, this shift may never be at a place where there's a finale to it. This may be an ongoing lifelong process. And so to continue to be curious, to continue to explore, to continue to create space for that individual, I'm such a believer in clinical environments, meeting folks where they're at, meeting folks from a place of recognizing the impact that stereotypes and oppression being discriminated against has on our lives, on our well-being. And so I just create as much as I can a space for that person to be free to explore and know that they are safe with me. And when that environment is created, I'm going to encourage them every single day to keep being curious about themselves.
Chris, thank you so much for calling in. Chris McLaughlin is with Inspired Consulting Group, a behavioral health provider and social worker. Before we move on, Penny Geisinger, I'm wondering if there's anything that Chris said that you'd like to build upon or really stood out to you.
Yeah, I love everything that Chris said. Thanks, Chris, for sharing all that. What I was thinking about while he was talking was this idea of identity. We all have so many different identities all at the same time, right? Like I'm a writer and I'm a mom and I'm a lesbian and I'm a person in recovery from substance use disorder. And in each of those sort of separate senses of self, I have a peer group, and peer support is, you know, and this is what I was thinking about when Chris was talking, just how important it is to be around people who understand you, that part of you who have been there. There's a safety built into that. There's a section in the book I talk about the first time that Kara and I traveled to Provincetown, Massachusetts together, which I mentioned earlier, which is a place where we were for the first time just really allowed to be open in public about who we were. And the safety that comes from that, being around your peer group, being around your people, it's transformative.
Calling in now is Susan Searle, who, like Penny, went through a shift in her identity and family life. Thanks so much for calling in, Sue.
It's a pleasure, Jennifer. I loved listening to Penny today. It's a great book. I haven't finished it yet, but I am in the process of it. And I have gone through a similar situation of life for me.
Tell us your story.
Well, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and at that time, obviously, if you had the slightest inclination that you were attracted to the same gender, you had to quash that down. That wasn't something that you just were so comfortable sharing. Followed the traditional, you know, you get married, you have a family, yada yada. And so I was married for over 16 years to a gentleman who was a very nice person, but I knew at that point in my life that I just could not live this untruth with him. It wasn't fair to him that I knew I was definitely attracted to women. We had a child together, wonderful adult now, but I had to take that big step and just say, this isn't working anymore for me, and I need a divorce. And that was a very difficult thing to tell him, because he is a really nice person. But I wanted our lives to be fair for both of us. So we did the divorce. My family wasn't very accepting. Amazingly, my parents were very accepting. It was my siblings. So it took a few years for my siblings to feel comfortable with my lifestyle. And I always said to them, I haven't changed at all. It's the same. I'm the same person. But being true to myself.
Sue, it's so interesting. As you say that, I haven't changed at all. Penny's nodding and smiling. So, yeah. Penny, you go ahead, Sue.
Yeah, I mean, Penny said the same thing in what she said a little bit earlier, that this she never really changed. She's just being true to who she is. Yeah. And that resonates with me.
Sue, how long ago did you go through a divorce?
Oh, gosh. I was divorced in 87 after 16 years of marriage. And I dated a woman for about 3 years. And then, you know, we went our separate ways, which was fine. And I didn't, you just kind of have groups of women that you hang with. And I didn't meet my partner, my soulmate and my wife, until 1995. And so we've now been together 30 years this past February. And we've been married now for 11 years. So it took me a span of time to, to know that I have found the person that I know I will be with for the rest of my life. And it was a wonderful experience. You feel very fulfilled. And Penny alluded to being in the Portland area now and not being asked one check or two. Also not feeling as comfortable just because of the world, the society's turmoil and all that's happening at the moment. And I concur with that completely. I don't feel quite as safe as I used to feel, which is a sad state of affairs.
I'm so sorry to hear that, Sue. I'm wondering, having read much of Penny's book, if you have any questions for her before we say goodbye.
Well, the one thing I would be interested in, knowing my situation when I asked for a divorce and blah, 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 if Penny's former husband held any animosity and anger towards her, and if so, has that subsided over the years? Do they have a good relationship? I'm curious.
It's a great question, Sue. So that marriage had been really struggling for a while, and so we decided that we could not be together anymore. And then I dropped the other news in sort of a part two to that conversation. By the way, I'm with this other person now, Kara, who he knew. And he said, I know, and it's great, and she's great, and you deserve it. And we have a very good relationship. We spend every holiday together because we were really clear from day one that the priority was on the kids, and because they were pretty little at the time. So we wanted, obviously it had a huge impact on them, but we wanted them to have, we both wanted to be with them all the time. And so we wanted them to have full access to us all of the time. So we have vacationed a little bit together. We're together every major holiday. There's a lot of communication and back and forth. And I'm really lucky because I know it doesn't always go that way. I'm aware that that was a privilege.
Yeah. And Sue, what about for you?
Happy to hear that. I'm sorry, Jennifer, say it again.
I was wondering about you and if you...
No, it was not pleasant. We co-parented together, shared the visitation, blah, blah, blah. But whenever we're at events where all the family is together, we literally don't speak. We kind of stay on different sides of the room. We just don't speak. And that's not my choice. But that's the way it is, and I've learned to live with it.
Well, Susan Searle, thank you so much for calling in. Thank you for sharing your story on Maine Calling today. I'm sure it has touched many people who are listening right now. Today on Main Calling, we're talking about the memoir, Shift. Our guest, Penny Geisinger, the author. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Main Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Joining me today is author Penny Geisinger. Her book, Shift, is a story of Penny's life experiences, her decision and marriage to a woman after being married to a man, and also an examination of how identity is a hard thing to pin down. Share your comments and questions. If you're quick, you can email us, talk@mainpublic.org. You can also call 1-800-399-3566. We will go to Allison calling from Portland. Hi, Allison. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. I'm not sure if I should have called right now, but I just find this fascinating. I found that quote about interpenetration of levels of time I just found that really poignant. There's a fancy Greek word for it called perichoresis, but we won't go there. The thing is, I've been involved with a woman for 30 years. We've been together, and boy, have we had our ups and downs. And I wasn't really sure. I don't want to shift gears here. Oof, shift. Anyway, but I don't know. I've almost. I'm usually don't hear your show live. I usually hear it repeated. And so. I don't want to get into another subject, but this is, I wasn't sure how much to say, but truth is I'm trans, but I was trans back when hardly anybody was trans. I'm 67 now. And I did the whole thing when I was in my early 20s. And then I met Eve, 31 years ago. And I was with some women before that. I tried a few things with guys and there was no zing with the strings in my heart. But I know some people get, I don't want to shift at all into really talking about transes because it's such a weighted subject nowadays. But I did find this whole thing, it just really, really struck me, and I really want to read your book and everything. I'm kind of getting drifting now. I never had like a normal, so-called, quote-unquote, normal life, so I don't, that whole side of it is funnily enough alien to me, you know, right? I never had did all that. And I was living, when I was very young, when you're talking about time and, you know, as I said, interpenetrating, I spend a lot of my time in my mind living in the past long ago because I was living in New York City in the early 80s and it was a really, really crazy rough time. And I did things that I felt, I was really cruel to people. I was, I just was really kind of crazy. And, I was cruel to a kitty, not physically. I gave her away when I shouldn't have, and I did lots of things. So part of my mind, even though we're very stable now, we're doing pretty darn well. Eve's 55 and I'm 67, so we're getting a bit older, and I'm having health problems and things and stuff. But we're pretty stable now. We had a good place. We have two kitties, but a part of me is living in the past always. It's in my mind. I cry
Allison,
about that a lot.
Allison, yeah. Thank you so much for calling in, and it clearly took courage for you to call in. And Penny, I'm wondering if what Allison said about living in the present, but then also living in the past is something that you can relate to.
I don't know anybody who can't relate to that. I think we all have, you know, active senses of where we've been, if we're lucky. And of course that affects our trajectory going forward. What I'm really thinking about, Allison, is I was having a little trouble making out what you were saying, but I think you said that they were trans.
Yes.
And I just want to acknowledge that that trans people in America right now are under siege, and you do a trans person, please do everything you can to help them feel as safe as they can, because it's a scary time to be trans in America right now.
Allison, thank you for your call. An email here from Margaret. My best friends have always been women. My bestie in high school wanted an intimate relationship. I loved her, but a sexual or physical relationship was repulsive to me. I never married, but in my 50s started a relationship with a man. Still not married, happy in my relationship of 25 years. But miss the intimacy and love I always had with that one woman. I still cannot have a physical relationship with any woman, still turned off. How do you feel about sexual relationships? And And, you know, Penny, I think that Margaret's email kind of speaks to the huge variety in that all of us have in our humanity and in part how important sexuality is to intimacy. It's probably different whoever you talk to.
I think that's true. I think, you know, I would have told you when I was straight and married to a man that I could, that I was not attracted to women. And that would have been partially inaccurate and partially just a lie because, you know, as I detail in the book, I was having an intimate relationship with a girl when I was in high school. We just pretended it was some other thing. And when this all first started unfolding for me, I had a conversation with a friend who said, she's like, yeah, I think some of us are just so straight that we could never be anything else. And some of us are so not that we could never be anything else. But most people are somewhere in the middle. Most people could find themselves attracted to any person that they are in love with.
Yeah,
we could unpack how true that is or not, but I've never forgotten it.
A related email from Maggie. Maggie writes, good grief. You'd have the world believe you cannot truly love someone without the sexual component. That women holding hands and showing public affection must be a couple. Affection and love get relegated to arcane notions. And, you know, this is one of the ironies here, Penny. You talk about how sometimes you're hesitant to hold hands. And somebody else might say, shouldn't everybody be allowed to hold hands, whether or not they're a couple?
Sure. I agree with that. And sometimes there are days we just don't want to deal with it. You know, we just don't want to deal with that person's looking at us in a way that we might think is weird. We don't know how to interpret it. Like, what's about to happen? Is something about, it's just exhausting. And so sometimes often it's just easier not to do that. And other times we're much more up for it. But it's like anything. It's different based on the day and where we're at and what else we're doing. And we don't want to be a statement all the time, right?
We'll go to Joyce, who's calling from Vermont. Hi, Joyce. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm very happy that you have written your story. Because it's really hard times right now. Because behavior is seen to be a solely psychological type of issue. But right now, from an environmental medicine standpoint, behavior is majorly hormonally controlled. And it's uncertain right now as to what proportion of any kind of behavior and any kind of feelings are not being affected by the massive number of endocrine hormone disrupting environmental chemicals that we're being exposed to. And it's just a really uncertain time right now, but there's enough evidence that that we're living in a soup of xenoestrogens and other hormone disrupting chemicals. And people have been put into situations that they have no control.
Sure. From. And yeah, we've done main calling programs on PFAS and the like. Penny, do you have any thoughts on Joyce's point?
I think we are all just walking bags of hormones and neurotransmitters and chemicals. So I'm not qualified to comment on the of my personal chemistry on my behavior, though I'm sure it plays a major factor.
Joyce, thanks for your call. An email here from Carrie Lee. How has the publication of your story changed you, your relationship with your wife, your family, your friends?
That's a terrific question. So first and foremost, the publication of the memoir changed my writing life, right? That is one of my identities as a writer. And so getting a book out into the world is a big deal to a writer. So it has added some swagger to my writer self. People read in private. And the people I have the most conversations with about the book are not the people that are closest to me. So it's an interesting question. Like, has it really changed my relationship to anybody that is close to me? I feel like it's a no. I certainly have a different kind of conversation with people that are not part of my closest circle. My kids, interestingly, who were little when all of this happened, are now college students. They have not read the book. I offered it to them when it was going out as manuscript, and they both said, no, thank you. I thought it was great. That's totally fine. I feel like my answer is a little weird, but I don't know. It's kind of, it sits in a strange place at the table, you know, of my closest family members and friends.
Yeah, it's interesting because Carrie Lee's question was about your family and friends, but our conversation with Susan made me think about, I'm wondering if you've had people read this book and reach out to you because it resonated with them and their life experience. Have you had strangers reaching out to you?
There's a little bit of that, yeah. We have Facebook, right? So people will friend request through Facebook and so there have been some connections that way. There have been connections with writers who have written about similar things. That's been an interesting realm of those of us who have tackled this as a topic. It has definitely put me in conversations that I would not have otherwise had, and it's terrific. You know, I love talking about it.
An email here from Charles. I just finished Shift by Penny Geisinger. I bought it to read Penny's story, but Penny's extraordinary writing ended up being the best part for me. I highly recommend it to all who love good writing. I'd like to know what's next from Penny. I'm ready to pre-order.
Oh, I like him. Who is that?
Charles.
Hi, Charles. Great. I do have a work in progress. I am working on the next book. I'm a little too superstitious to say very much about it. We'll just say that it's a generational story with a very salacious murder at its heart. And
so a novel?
No, it's a memoir. It's a memoir.
Wait a minute.
I'm not murdered, nor am I the murderer, but several generations ago, there was a gruesome murder that will be at the heart of this crazy story. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you mentioned, you know, I was very curious because it seems as though your memoir maybe ends in about 2012 and 13 years ago. And you say that both of your kids are in college now and you're still married to Kara. Is there any other update that's important to know for people who read Shift and leave wondering, okay, how's everything going today?
Geez, things are pretty smooth. We're still gardening and we're still living in the woods and we're sailing now. We weren't sailing when I wrote the book and it's a marriage. It's amazing and it's wonderful, and as someone, one of the callers said, like, it has ups and downs, right? So we're just doing what we do and living. I have a busy day job in public health, and we have a couple of dogs, and
you're sober.
And I'm sober. I am 8.5 years sober, and that's a gift as well.
Because that is a thread through this memoir that you touch on over and over again, but is a little bit unresolved.
It's always going to be unresolved. It's interesting you say that. It was part of the story. It's part of my story. It's an incredibly important part of my story. And it wasn't like the story that I wanted to tell with this book, right? So I had to find a balance as the writer of that story of how do I make sure that that's in there and addressed, but doesn't, you know, elbow its way to the front of the room, because it wasn't the story that I have written about it in other places, but that wasn't this story. So, but yeah, that's always unfolding.
All right. And I see a cello, I believe, over your shoulder. So you're still playing music.
I am playing music. I don't really play the cello very much, but but it looks really good in Zoom meetings, and I will get back to it. Kara and I are still performing as a band. So that's an update.
Great. You have the same name?
We do. We are still the Pink Capos. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Penny Geisinger, the author of the award-winning book, Shift, A Memoir of Identity and Other Illusions. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we talk with more authors. It's part of our Good Books to Read This Summer show. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.